Hey everybody, this is Ben Morton and thank you for joining me for another episode of the podcast. In this episode, episode number 9, I'm joined by Samantha Seaton, who is the CEO of MoneyHub, an award-winning digital financial tool for customer-centric organizations and a leading player in the field of open banking. Sam has worked across a diverse mix of organizations, from global advisory and consulting firms such as Towers Watson to innovative financial forecasting businesses. Yet her unwavering ambition to make financial advice and information accessible to all remains absolutely constant. That purpose-driven ambition became very apparent very quickly in our conversations, which led me to ask Sam about whether a sense of purpose or knowing your why is truly important for leaders, or is it just hype and the latest leadership or management fad? Alongside that, we got deep into the weeds discussing resilience, tenacity, and her take on deliberately putting yourself in positions where you feel deeply uncomfortable. For me, though, the most interesting part of our conversation was Sam's methodology for deciding when to stick with a plan and when to change tack. So, having teed up another great episode for you, please enjoy my conversation with Sam Seaton. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Yes, I am in good form. It's the rain has stopped for a little bit, so you know, being a British citizen now rather than an Australian citizen, I'm very weather dependent.
So, Sam, the first question I always love to ask guests on the show, just to give everybody a little bit of context, really, is kind of what's the current role right now? What are you doing, and what's the potted history or the career journey that got you there?
Yeah, so I'm the CEO of MoneyHub, and MoneyHub is a fast-growing business that aggregates people's data. It's intelligence-based, software as a service. So it is all about the consumer, but from the enterprise's perspective, in that we sell to the enterprise so that they can have a way better relationship with their customers. So that's fundamentally what I'm doing at the moment. And I guess how I got here, is that was the other part of your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I genuinely have a fairly checkered journey to where I am now. I grew up in Australia, so I'm obviously Australian born and bred. And actually, if it wasn't for my uncle, I would definitely be a nurse, not the CEO of MoneyHub. And that's because when I was at kind of in last part of high school, you know, all of my friends were going to go and do nursing. And so I put nursing down, you know, when I was doing my A-levels, what you call your A-levels, which is our TE in Australia. I put nursing down, and my uncle said, I don't think he'd make a very good nurse. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not going to make a good nurse. And he said, well, I just think, you know, there are other things you could do that you would be better at. And I said, well, like what? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, but let's sit down. In those days, sadly, because it's quite a long time ago, he took me through the paper and all the jobs that were in the paper. And he said, do any of these interest you? And, you know, it starts with accountants on, you know, A for accountants, and it works its way through. And I was very intrigued by a role which was described as a systems analyst. And I said, well, that looks, out of all these jobs I've seen, that looks really interesting. And I said, what is that to him? And he said, well, it's something to do with computing. But he said, I don't know what. So he said, you need to ask your computer teacher at school. And I'm sure, you know, he'll be able to help you, you know, find out what you'd need to do with that. And that's what I did. So the irony is I put computer science down as my first choice at university, and then nursing. So if I hadn't got in to do computer science, I'd definitely be a nurse.
So wow, what an incredible story.
Yeah, so that's the first kind of intervention I think I had that's probably taken me to where I am. So then I did my computer degree, and then was a graduate programmer for Telstra. And although it's not much different now to really when I was doing it. So it was in the late 80s, and there were three women in the computer degree that I did out of 120 started and 60 finished, 60 graduated roughly, and there was still the three women that had started on the first year. So and my understanding is that it is a bit better than that now, but not a lot better. So I guess that's disappointing to think that, you know, not more women are having the stimulation and rewarding kind of career that you can have through the STEM subjects, which would be good to address at some point. But anyway, I've kind of lived in a very male-dominated world from the very beginning of my career, which is fine. And then went into my graduate programming, job with Telstra, and that was amazing because I look back at that and think, you know, they had a graduate program which meant that you got exposed to a lot of other courses because you were just a graduate. It didn't really matter what graduate program you were on. So you got to go on courses about presentation skills and even things like confidence in speaking around a table, your ideas, how ideas could be heard and shared. So I think they were quite a progressive business when you look back on it, to have all of that. I will admit that the course that all of the women were put on, the diversity course, which all of the women were invited to attend, which was a course about how to be more challenging. Right. And I didn't get to go on that one because my boss didn't think I needed to be more challenging. I haven't forgotten that either because that was quite funny. So I think that tells you something about what I must have been like to manage. But anyway, so then a bit of a sideline that brings me to the UK because in my kind of serious hobby mode, I've always loved my horses and eventing, so three-day eventing. And at that stage, I had an amazing horse that I was competing on who caught the eyes of the Australian selectors. And in order to be considered for team selection at any kind of world championships or Olympics, you didn't have to compete internationally forever, but you did have to compete internationally or you couldn't be picked. So they asked me if I was interested in competing internationally with my horse. And I thought it was a ridiculous idea because I thought taking a horse to the US or to the UK, I honestly thought it sounded ridiculous. And I went home and I was talking to my husband about all of this at the time. And he said to me, when you're 80 years of age in your rocking chair, do you want to think about the things that you have done or the things you could have done?
Wow.
And I was like, that was it. I was like, he's absolutely right. I'm going, like we're going, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So that was it. So then I, obviously the Australian Equestrian Federation, they don't pay for everything, but they help you, you know, I landed in the UK with my horse in Andrew Hoy's yard, who's a famous three-day event Olympian, three times, world champion, gold medalist. So I landed with him. So, you know, they facilitate all of that. And obviously without that, it would be very difficult. And then I did compete professionally on the eventing circuit right up until the year 2000. And Badminton, Burley, Blenheim, I discovered mussels and chips at a three-day event at Boccolo in Holland, which were amazing. Right. So, yeah, I have been a fan of mussels and chips ever since. I had a really an amazing time actually doing that. But sadly, I didn't get picked. I didn't get picked for the Australian team for the Sydney 2000 Olympics. I was very close. My horse wasn't quite good enough in the dressage phase, not my favourite phase either. So maybe it's the two of us. We missed out. And it made me think, you know, do I want to keep doing this? It's every 4 years. There's a lot of pressure to kind of build up, and then it's so easily missed. You know, either because you're not quite good enough for the team on that occasion or because your horse actually has an injury. A lot of my friends' horses get injured, you know, all the time, and it's very, very disheartening. So I thought, I don't think this is the life that I want to lead. You know, I love my horses and my eventing, but I don't think I want to compete internationally professionally forever. So that's when I went back actually to the world of work that I had come from. And I went back to a career in IT, if you like. So I got a job with Towers Perrin, and I grew up really with Towers Perrin in terms of my career. So I worked with Tillinghast, which is the institutional financial services practice of Towers Perrin back in 2000. And that's really where I learned all that I know about financial services. And yes, I joined Tillinghast Towers Perrin, and I knew nothing about financial services. But as you can imagine, in the year 2000, everyone wanted the internet. People wanted spreadsheets to become models that you could all, you know, log into basically from different places. And so there was a whole shift going on, in addition to the dot-com, you know, bubble. But and that's where I started my career, if you like, in terms of where I am now. And without, you know, a few key people on that journey, you know, I wouldn't really be where I am now. So there's probably, you know, four or five key people that without them, I wouldn't have the understanding that I've got. So they're very patient with me, because as you can imagine, they all had a financial services background in the main, not an IT background. So actuaries by profession and things like that. So I had some really great mentors along the way. And I guess I would say that without those mentors, I wouldn't be where I am now. And so then I had an opportunity in 2011 when Towers Perrin and Watson Wyatt merged. We had a team of four of us had the opportunity to MBO eValue from Towers Perrin. And so the four of us MBO'd the business to not only focus on taking stochastic forecasting and modelling of risk and return from the institutional space that we'd been in, but actually to take it more to the retail market, which interested me a lot, because one of the things I had learned in my time at Towers is that it's very difficult for consumers, people, you know, that are not from a financial services background, to understand financial services products and services. So the products and services that we as an industry bring to market. And it's not because consumers are idiots or not bright enough or don't care. It's none of that. It's actually impossible. I just decided that unless you had worked in financial services or were particularly interested, you know, in that area, it's just not really possible for you to understand it. And I kind of relayed a little bit to like a car. So if, for example, I'd had to take an engine apart and put it back together in order to get my license, I would be on a bus.
Right, yeah.
I'm not remotely interested in taking a car apart and putting it back together in order to drive the car. I mean, I'm not saying I couldn't do it if you made me. You know, I'm not saying that. It just doesn't interest me.
Yeah.
And I think that 90% of the people, you know, would be like me and be on the bus. You know, they just wouldn't want to do that. And then 10% genuinely would love taking the car apart and putting it back together and have their license. So I just kind of felt that anything I could do to take the knowledge that I had and the technology interest and always that kind of passion for that area further and further to the consumer so that it would help them to make informed decisions with their money, the better. So I was quite key to doing that, and really enjoyed doing the 5 years at eValue as the CEO of that business, where we took, you know, the modeling capability and placed it through enterprises again, through the business world, but placed it into the hands of consumers so that they could make more informed choices in terms of their money. And then actually went from there to MoneyHub. So went from eValue to MoneyHub, had the opportunity to take a role in MoneyHub when it was owned by Momentum Global Investment Management, which is, you know, MGIM in my world, to help commercialize MoneyHub. And I saw it as being that next step as getting even closer to a product and a service that really empowered the consumer. Like, genuinely, I kind of felt I'd made it. And so thoroughly enjoyed that role. But actually, within a year of taking that role on, had the opportunity to MBO that business from MGIM and jumped at the chance with three of my colleagues. And that's how I've ended up. you know, the CEO of MoneyHub.
Well, it's a quite some journey, Sam. Just listening to you talk there, I've got a long list of questions already that I would love to ask you that weren't on my original list of questions. I'm already thinking maybe at some stage in the future we might need to see if we can convince you to come back on the show for an episode two, because I'd love to talk about the eventing and your journey to possibly being an Olympian and the crossovers that has with business and what you learned. But the one question I would love to pick up on from what you've just said is, it sounds to me as though from what you've described, there were a number of sort of key opportunities. Your uncle suggested maybe you could do something else instead of nursing, the opportunity to go to the UK with your horse riding, a couple of management buyout opportunities. It sounds like you have had these opportunities throughout your career where you could maybe be bold, take a risk, kind of stretch yourself. And you jumped and took a lot of those. I wonder, to what degree do you think being bold is important for a leader? And if so, like, where does that courage to take a leap come from for you?
So I think you definitely have to be bold. I think you've got to be willing to put yourself in environments or places where you are clearly out of your depth and clearly uncomfortable. And the only way, to me, that you really progress is by doing that. And it isn't just in work; it's in anything you do in life. I think. So I personally believe the only way you'll achieve more is by definition by being vulnerable, because you have to be vulnerable to get better, because you have to be in effect. You know, you've got to push yourself into an area where you may know very little about the subject or actually how to do what you're tackling, but without going there, you know you'll never get any further, will you? So I think that is pretty key. I don't know what the right word for it is, whether it's brave or bold or even, you know, some people I guess would say stupid, right? You know, I mean, just, you know, a bit crazy. I don't know, but that you definitely have to have, I probably like to call it curiosity, you know, that you're curious enough to want to know a bit more about what you don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also curious as well, you talked about even right back to doing your computing degree. I think you said you were one of three women from a course of 100 and 120, and then your first job was quite male dominated. Are there any particular things you can put your finger on that you think have helped make you kind of successful and get you to where you are in what sounds like a pretty male dominated environment?
So I think, I mean, I have to say, it's only more recently that I've become aware of how undiverse some, you know, sections are. And I think that's because when you do something, like if you think about it, you know, 18, I went to uni, and from that point on, it was a male-dominated environment. So I didn't really think anything of it. I mean, I honestly have to say to you, for a long time, it never even occurred to me that it's possible there are things I missed out on because I'm a girl, right? It wouldn't have really occurred to me, because I wouldn't have thought that's possible, right? You know, I think the reason from that mindset has to come or be is really down to my dad, because I have a brother, so a younger brother, but I was the older sister. But my dad, he actually treated us the same. I mean, when I look back on it, and there are things that he did with us, I think that genuinely probably made you or made me think that, you know, you can do anything you want to do. You know, and I think sometimes we probably underestimate the confidence that you need to be given as a child, perhaps in order to achieve, or perhaps that's not the right, perhaps there are other leaders that it's by not having that drove them on. But I guess coming back to your earlier point about what is it that takes you to be that drive? I think you need some kind of passion or drive, whether it's because you're cross you didn't get something or because you were given something that's made it very possible. I guess what it boils down to is your inner tenacity to get something done or achieve something you want to achieve. I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah. And where does that come from for you? What's the well of that drive or tenacity?
So I think it probably built up in Towers Parent in terms of my work, you know, like over time, about seeing very clearly how consumers, so I kind of have given this analogy to another person. So it's like, if you and I, Ben, if you and I go into a shop to buy a coat, you know, like a waterproof coat to go walking up a hill, that's what we've both gone into the shop for. We will both come out with coats, you know, like and jackets, you know, and, you know, yours might be waterproof and mine might be breathable and yours might be really long and mine might be short and elasticated cuffs. I mean, that one thing is for sure, that you and I will come out with two different coats.
Yeah.
And I believe that you'll have made an informed decision about the coat that you buy and why you've bought it, and the same for me. And so when we walk up our mountain, you know, if I get drenched because I didn't buy the waterproof one, I'll be okay with that, because actually when I was walking up the mountain, I was a bit cooler than you. You know, you had to put up with being a bit more sweaty, you know, because I guess that's the bit that upset me about financial services and people with their money, is that I would like people to be able to make that informed decision. But I honestly feel people have products, whether it's their mortgage or their insurance products, or it doesn't really matter, you know, their investments. And I genuinely think they have no idea what type of coat they've got.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I know exactly.
That just isn't right, is it? Like, hard-earned money that you need, A, to live on today, and also B, to secure your financial future. And you actually can't tell what it is, or where it is, or what it's doing. If something about that just isn't right.
Yes, another question that, again, wasn't on the original list, so apologies for that. But so from what you've just said, and from before we hit record and jumped on this call, I just had a look at your LinkedIn profile, as people do, just doing a bit of research. And from your biography on the Money Hub website as well, I did get this real strong sense that you do what you do out of a real passion and belief. Around sort of people having all the information to make informed choices. And I mean, there's a lot written and talked about these days in terms of leaders and individuals having a clear purpose or knowing their why, based on kind of the work of Simon Sinek.
Yeah. But
like, how important do you think that is for a leader to have a strong sense of purpose or know their why? Is it really important, or is it sort of slightly over-egged and a bit of hype, do you think?
I don't think it's over-egged. I think it's pretty key, but personally, I mean, I obviously can't, you know, maybe there's leaders out there that can do this without having that. I don't think I could. I mean, I think you have to, you know, when you end up working late or doing those extra things that you question your sanity on, that's when I think you've got to know why you're doing it, because that's what keeps you going. That's what drives you through those down times or those troughs or those difficult bits or doing the work that, you know, genuinely, you know, that you find hard or challenging. That, I mean, I don't know how else you get through that if you don't have that why.
Yeah, brilliant. So jumping back to some of the questions we planned to ask. So looking at your career journey and history, how do you think that has shaped you as a leader, Sam? And what are some of the big or main leadership lessons you've learned along the way?
So can I come on to that? I just got one thing that I thought might be worth sharing, you know, if people are listening to this, in terms of, you know, aspiring to progress, if you like, you know, and climbing, in effect, a career ladder. It's just one thought I had, it wasn't, you know, if you roll back, I don't know, 15 years, I don't think I could have answered what my why was that I can now articulate like we have just done. So I guess one thing I would say is that don't panic if you're not 100% sure right now what your why is, because it may build over time. You know, don't sit there and think, well, I'll never be able to be, what is it, a leader or CEO or an MD or something, because I don't know what my why is. Because I think sometimes they can creep up on you, or it builds and then it catches you, and then it's like a little fire that smoulders for a bit, and then once it catches, there's no stopping you. And I think that can happen to anyone at any point in their journey. So yeah, just to not panic people to think that if they're sitting there thinking, well, I don't know what my why, you know, because I have a feeling that at some point in my growing up at Towers Perrin, if you'd said to me, you know, what's your why, I might have been a bit like a rabbit in headlights, you know, at that point.
Yeah, that's incredible. Thank you for sharing that, because I think you're right. I think some of us can beat ourselves up a bit, or feel kind of we are not clear on our career path, or we're not good enough if we haven't got our why nailed on right. So I think you're absolutely right. Reminds me of the I think it's by Baz Luhrmann, the Wear Sunscreen song, where he talks about some people are going to leave university not knowing what they want to do. Some of the most interesting people I know still don't know what they want to do at 40, right? So yeah. Yeah, brilliant. Thank you for that.
So sorry, so your question that I haven't answered.
Yeah, what are some of the main leadership lessons you've learned along the way, and how has that journey shaped you as a leader?
I think you are always shaped by what you do along the way. So that's why I think everyone is unique. I think everyone gets to where they get to along a slightly different path. So without a doubt, I have been shaped by my past. I mean, I think that's a given. And I guess a few of the key things that have shaped me, I definitely have been shaped by my experience, you know, riding at a top level in a sport. I mean, we had sports psychology and all sorts as a team member, you know, you get spoiled really, you know, in terms of the effort that gets put into you as an athlete. So I would argue that some of that has had an impact on what I've been able to achieve. And then also I think that being able to dig deep and that tenacity I talk about, I mean, without a doubt, I would have learned that through my riding. I mean, what do they say? Don't work with, what is it, animals and children on
yeah,
TV?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I remember walking a cross-country course with one of my friend's daughters, and she was madly telling us that, you know, horse events only go right one. She her statistics that she came up with was 1 in 19. So
wow,
you know,
okay.
And she was about, I don't know, she must have been about 13 or 14. That was her opinion. And I was about to correct her, you know, I was about to say, oh no, that's ridiculous. And I thought about it, I thought, do you know what? She's probably right.
Wow.
You know, she's probably got it a bit probably bang on when you think about the number of times it goes wrong before it actually goes really right. So I think that's the other thing, you know, you learn that you can't get everything right the first time. You've got to be willing to explore a bit. You've got to be willing for it to go wrong in order to get it right. And the one thing I've learned that I think is important is that you have to know when to hang on to a decision, like through thick or thin, you know, to get to the other side. And then there's other times when you've got to think, do you know what, I'm just wrong. Like I've got to rethink this, or I've got to do this a different way, because the way I'm going about it is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. And how do you know the answer to that? Or what's your process for sort of analyzing and working out whether it's the right decision you want to stick with, or whether you've got it wrong and you need to change tack? Because that's a question I get asked a lot in my work. Like, how do you, what's the line between sort of insanely, stupidly following a plan versus sort of holding your nerve and sticking to the decision you've made or the path you've chosen?
So I don't think there's an easy, there's no easy answer to this, as in I don't think it's ever going to be able to be written in a book, you know, and something you learn from a book. I do think you have to learn it a little bit from trial and error. So I think, first of all, you have to be willing to trial and error. So, you know, you have to be willing to try things and test things out and then try things a different way. Because I think if you if you don't do that, or you've never done that in anything that you've ever tried in your life, then I think you would want to stick to a plan, because I just think that's how you'll work. And so I think, first of all, be willing to trial and error things. And then I think the other thing is, I'm quite results orientated. So to me, you make a decision and you stick to it until you can see a result one way or the other.
Okay.
So to me, it's all about, you've got to keep going. So I won't really stop something until I've got a definitive answer one way or the other, a bit that tells me quite clearly. So when I'm in the area of grey, I will keep going. Do you know what I mean? If I'm sure this is right, I think we've got to keep going. I'll keep everyone going and try and take everyone with me and say, come on, you know, but then as soon as you get a, do you know what? You know, this has happened 3 times in a row now, and every time that hasn't worked. I think you have to take stock. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily mean you've got the wrong, you know, you shouldn't keep going. That is not what I'm saying, but you've got to be willing, I think, to change your tact. And sometimes when you analyze it, you'll think, actually, why don't we try this? You know, why don't we do this instead? And I'm quite open. I'm quite collaborative in that approach. So I'm quite willing to sit down with people that I think can help inform that decision and say, what do you think? You know, here's what we've done and here's what has worked and what hasn't. But to me, we should be here and we're not. You know, so what do you think? And either we adjust where we're going slightly, or we all agree we need to keep going a bit further because we're not quite there yet, or we actually all agree we should try something else. And I just think the role of a leader in that point is to know how far to go and keep everyone going until, you know, they need to say, do you know what? I think we should just take stock. And that I think I have learned. That is something I think you learn, and it takes time. Some people are obviously quicker at it than others, but I don't think people should beat themselves up about it. I also think that it comes with coming back to the why and also a certain amount of confidence. So you've got to have a bit of self-belief, you know, to kind of, when it's a bit grey, not to stop, because grey isn't no or yes to me. Grey is nothing.
Wow, that's incredible. That's really, really insightful. Thank you for that. I guess following on from that question, Sam, are there any particular sort of leadership models, tools or frameworks that you've picked up along the way throughout your journey that have sort of stuck with you and you sort of fall back on?
So yeah. I think growing up in Taoist Peron, I was very lucky to see a lot of different frameworks and models because it is fundamentally a consultancy business. And so you do get exposed to an awful lot of very high quality frameworks and models. And I guess what I would say is that I'm not wedded to one or another particularly. So I would have to put my hand up and say, no, I don't, I'm not a, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say use this model or that model.
Yeah.
But what I would say is that I have drawn benefits from many models over the time. You know, I've definitely taken, you know, the parts that have worked well. And I think you've got to be willing to accept that certain models will work better in certain situations. So just be a bit clever about how you take from one and apply it. They're not, you know, it's not one size fits all forever. But I think I haven't really relied on one model ever. I'm quite happy to flex around, you know, the world of frameworks and models. But having said that, you know, one of the questions that you asked me is about the books, you know, about what books I've read and have influenced me. And one of the early books that I would have to cite as being an early influencer was The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. He wrote it, I think, in 2011. And that would have been around the time when we MBO'd eValue from Towers Watson, as it was then.
Right.
And I would argue that would have had, you know, some influence on me. And probably to this day, my slight obsession with automation.
Right.
As well as my love for technology, because obviously that's quite, you know, I'm quite steeped in it, but also the Lean Startup, it, you know, it's about it's about being efficient, and it's about doing what you need to do rather than what you want to do. And I think in business today, because of the speed at which technology moves, the speed at which the consumer expectation moves, I'm very mindful of that book and the principles in it, in that you need to need to be willing to move at speed, and you need to be willing, and the only way you can move at speed is being light on your feet, in effect, can't you? As a business, the business needs to be light on its feet. So I would argue that any principle or model or framework that helps you as a business remain light on your feet is pretty critical.
Wow, that's great, great stuff. And seeing as you mentioned it, obviously you mentioned the lean startup, kind of what are kind of some other books that have kind of been influential, had an impact, if any others?
So there's two books. I mean, I read another one along the same time, you know, around the lean startup, MBOing the business. I would have read a lot. I mean, I still read a lot, actually, but I don't have as much time to read now as I like. But I would have read a lot because it's such a transition time coming from Towers Perrin, you know, true employee, if you like, into the world of running your own business. And the other one that really stood out to me at that time is Delivering Happiness, A Path to Profits, Passion and Purpose by Tony High. And okay. He is basically he was the founder and CEO of Zappos.com.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And the reason I read it is because I remember thinking, if anyone can sell a business in 10 years from naught to £1 billion to Amazon by starting an online shop selling shoes, I've got to read it, right? I mean,
They're worth listening to.
Yeah, I mean, of all the things you could decide to kick off from naught, and that is selling shoes online, and I'm like, I've got to read it. Wow. So, yeah. So they're the two that stand out to me that, for me personally, I would say were the two, the Lean Startup and Delivering Happiness by Tony High, but also one I've read more recently, which I really enjoyed and honestly just loved every page, was Let It Go by Dame Steve Shirley.
Okay.
And she, it's her autobiography. So it's not a management book per se, except it almost reads like fiction. It's so easy to read, right, you know, rather than nonfiction, which it is. And on top of that, I mean, if you need a little bit of inspiration, motivation, and insight into what you can achieve as a human being, then just read that book. It is incredible.
Amazing. I will add it onto my reading list. I'll probably go on Amazon as soon as we finish this chat, and I'll add it to the basket, right? Cool. And what else are you reading, learning about, curious about right now, Sam?
I think really at the moment my life is steeped in trying to get us from, at the moment we live in, from my world at Money Hub, in an open banking world. Everyone's obsessed about open banking, whereas obviously I've always been obsessed about open finance, and even more widely than that, open data. So at the moment, a lot of my reading, research and work that I do is probably a little bit duller than normal in that I'm steeped in I guess the standards and the internationalization of open data and how that might be possible, practical, feasible in the future. So that's really where my head's at the moment.
Great stuff. Sam, I always want to be really conscious of people's time when they give up their time to come on the show. So I've probably just got a couple of slightly more quick fire questions to finish up with, if that's okay. The first one is, do you have any particular routines, ways of working, habits, rituals that serve you well as a leader, enable you to be effective and play at your best?
So I'm the worst one to ask for that, because I thrive on flexibility rather than routine. So routine kind of kills me. So that's probably, you know, you're answering one. But having said that, I ride my horses every morning. So that's what I love to do. I ride early, you know, so I ride first thing. And genuinely, it doesn't really matter what happens after that. I mean, genuinely doesn't matter what happens after that. I'm not bothered. Like, the day can go as it was planned to go, according to my diary. It can be turned upside down, put through the ringer, and out the other side, and I will be equally fine with that. I'm not rattled by change at all. In fact, I'd almost say it slightly keeps me on my toes, which is where I operate best.
Yeah, that's great. Many leaders I talk to actually describe to me how either when they are out running, cycling, riding their horse, whatever it may be, they say that's where actually they do a lot of their best thinking, get lots of the best ideas for the business, kind of solve problems. Do you find, is that true for you as well?
Yes, I think it works slightly differently. I think my riding kind of clears the deck is how I put it. So it's like yoga for me. It's like my brain kind of goes, I don't really think about work when I'm riding. I've often wondered about that, because even when I'm just going for a hack around, in the countryside, you'd think about work then, wouldn't you? You might be walking on the back of a horse, which you've done since you were little, so it's not exactly taxing. But somehow it doesn't work like that. It kind of takes me out, into a different, I don't think about work. And so I think that kind of clears my deck. But I often have my best thoughts in the shower.
Yeah, that's pretty common.
And also, unfortunately, which annoys me a bit actually, last thing at night. So I will be literally about to fall asleep. And honestly, I will think, oh, and I've learned from experience that I'll never remember the next day. In fact, that annoys me. So then I'm like, I wonder what it was I was thinking about. So I now have a pad beside my bed, like a notepad, because I can literally scribble in the dark, So I now have a pen and paper, which is beside my bed. So when I have those moments, I actually just scribble them down, because otherwise I find it difficult to go to sleep, because I'm like, oh, I'm not going to remember that, because I know I won't remember it because it's happened to me before. And then on top of that, some of them are good ideas, right? Some of them might be good ideas that you want to kind of capture. And they're not often things that are really important for the next week or so and things. They are often things that are slightly longer term.
Amazing. Brilliant. And final question, Sam, if you could give just one piece of advice to somebody who is aspiring to or about to step into their first MD or CEO role, what would that piece of advice be?
So I think my piece of advice I'd give is that the more senior your role gets, the more commercial reality bites. So just be aware of that. So be aware that, if you're first stepping into an MD role, just be aware that the level of commercial acumen that you should have and should want to have is going to be much more than possibly any other role you've had before that. And so I guess be respectful of that, because that's part of why you're an MD, CEO, or in a senior position in a company. And then the second thing I think that goes with that I think people perhaps maybe forget or don't acknowledge, is that you need to then take a lot less personally. So just remember that when you operate at that next level, it's all about business. It's all about the goals and the results. And I would say try not to take what people say to you or do, even actions, don't take them personally. Try and take it at a very factual business sense. I just think a lot of people take things personally and they shouldn't.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think it almost brings us really nicely, Sam, full circle to where we started. And what I think I probably heard is a bit of a theme from so much of what you've said. Like, I've picked up a sense of sort of resilience, sort of grit, determination has been core to your career and your success, which I think links with what you said just now, right, about kind of not taking things personally.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I learned it. I think I was very young, and I can remember I got bucked off a pony. I mean, honestly, it must be like seven times in a row. I mean, and the guy that was helping me or teaching me, you know, he said to me, you need to relax more. And he said, and you need to just, you know, go with the movement more. And he said, rather than, you know, against it. And he said, and once you've learned that, you'll be a cracking rider. And I remember going home that night to my mum, and I was in tears because I said to her, he thinks I'm a really bad rider. And she had to tell me that that's not what he said. and I learned it really early on is that when people say things to you, that more often than not, they're trying to help you. And yet if you take it personally, it can get in the way of that help.
Yeah, incredible.
So when you get really senior, I think it's really important to try and remember that.
And I think what a brilliant piece of advice for life in general, not just leadership and not just learning to ride a horse, right? Kind of relax more, go with the movement, and things will be good.
Yeah, exactly. I know, it's amazing, isn't it? How we had a session for the Money Hub team actually a year or so ago. I don't know if you know, but mental health is quite a big issue for STEM, in that you know, a lot of people find communication quite difficult or awkward. It's not a natural part, and so therefore by not communicating sometimes issues get bottled up. So we had a person come in to talk about how you can deal with that kind of issue, if you like. And the thing that stood out to me again was that they said that our brains like to it's like a seesaw, and it always wants to be either in the past or in the future, but it never wants to sit in equilibrium in the present.
Right.
And I thought, oh my God, that's amazing, isn't it? It's so true. Our brains are always either a million miles in front or thinking a million miles back. But he was just saying that we just need to steady them and just be in the present. And actually, to be honest, that's going to be, you know, the most useful thing you can kind of do. And I've not forgotten that either. And that was only a couple of years ago.
It's incredible. Sam, there is so much I think we can learn from, use, apply from that conversation. So I really appreciate your time, taking time out of your busy day to come on the show. I know everyone listening is gonna love it and take so much away from it. So one final time, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
So there you have it, folks, my conversation with Sam Seaton. For me, some of the most powerful stuff that she shared was around sticking with a decision until you have a definitive answer one way or another. And her view that when you're in the grey, just keep going, because grey isn't no, it's not yes, it's actually nothing at all. So as I say, I hope you found that episode massively valuable. If you did, it would be incredible if you could share the link out via your social media, and also subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. It helps us grow the audience and enables us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and CEOs such as Sam. That's it for this episode. Take care, folks, and lead on.